Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro. And this week, my guest is the astronomer at the International Dark Sky Association, Dr. John Barentine. John, welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show, John.
Thank you for joining me. I've got a lot of questions for you about the International Dark Sky Association, which is something near and dear to all of our hearts who have an astronomy background. And I want to thank you for your work on that. But first, I wanted to ask you about your career and your background. For the listeners, you are currently the Director of Conservation for the International Dark Sky Association in Tucson, Arizona. You earned a master's degree in physics at Colorado State, yay, and earned your PhD at the University of Texas at Austin. Throughout your career, you've been involved in education and outreach efforts to help increase public understanding of science, otherwise known as a science communicator. So, I've had several astronomers and astrophysicists on the show, and they've all had a fascinating story to tell me about what inspired them to pursue their career. So tell me about yours.
Well, John, I've had in physics, what we would say, a very nonlinear career that was partially academic and now is moved into a very different sector. I started off very young with an interest in astronomy and wanted to find a way to be professionally involved in it somehow, and did that for a while and got the full academic credentials and participated in some interesting research, but eventually got to the point where there were some realities involved with the job market in academia that are not so great right now and have not been for some number of years. But also,
finding a tenure track position in astronomy is a little tough.
Yeah, it's almost impossible anymore. But also just a dawning realization that there were so many other things that I wanted to do besides something having to do with research. There's so many other things in life I just wanted to accomplish. And so what I tell people is about my current job, that what I do now is more, I think, in service to astronomy rather than advancing the knowledge forward. But I think that that's something that is equally valuable to the field of astronomy.
What was the trigger point? For a lot of us, it was looking at Saturn through an Edmonds scientific reflector. I've had lots of astronomers and astrophysicists on the show, Dr. Chiara Mingarelli especially, would go out in the night skies in Canada with her friends and started looking at the stars, and Brian Keating was on the show, and he looked at a moon one night through a telescope when he was 12, and it's like something just triggers, it snaps, and you go, wow, I want to know everything there is to know. How about you?
My story is a little bit different than those and doesn't involve that sort of specific aha moment in looking through a telescope, but rather has to do with the fact that I grew up here in Arizona, which is the headquarters of the U.S. National Observatory at a place called Kitt Peak. That's a little bit to the west of Tucson. And my aha moment came on a visit to Kitt Peak when I was 5 years old. My grandparents took me there. They took me and my brother all over Arizona to learn about the state and the things that we have here. And there was something about being in that place with all of these telescope domes on this remote mountaintop. And, you know, it was a daytime visit, so I didn't even get to see the night sky. But at the end of that day, I said to my grandparents, I'm going to come back here and work someday. Yeah. And I'm sure they were thinking, you know, next week it'll be, you want to be a garbage man or something like that.
Kitt Peak will do that to you. I had a tour when I was with Apple, and I got a grand tour of the Mail and all the telescopes there. And it's an impressive facility.
It's really unlike most observatories where there's one or two domes. It's almost like this sort of a monastic community of people who live there and work with the telescopes. And so fast forward years later to the first semester that I was in college here at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and I had started working with some people at the observatory on a little research project, and they invited me to come out and observe with them at one of the telescopes. And so we had a cloudy night, and I wandered down to the dining hall and picked up the phone and called my grandparents, and I told them where I was, and I said, I told you I would keep my promise.
So this was with the NOAO.
That's correct.
Can you tell us about what the NOAO is real briefly?
Yeah, it stands for National Optical Astronomy Observatory, and it is the federally funded and managed organization that operates the telescopes both in here in Tucson and Hawaii and Chile that are made available to the general community of American research astronomers to gather data for their research.
There's also an equivalent NRAO, the National Radio Astronomy Observatories. They're in Charlottesville, Virginia, I think.
Yes, that's right. And so as NOAO is to the optical visible wavelengths of light, the NRAO does all of the management of the radio astronomy facilities that are publicly available in America.
So if I read your bio right, you started off as a classic astronomer. That means working at the telescope, right?
Yes, I did. That was the first sort of professional job that I had. I worked at a facility called Apache Point Observatory in New Mexico for about 5 years, and did that sort of classical mode, as we call it, observing where there's one person at a telescope and you're running the show. And then eventually later on, I became involved in something called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which has turned out to be one of the most momentous astronomy projects in history and is still producing lots of exciting research results almost 20 years after it began.
Is all of that being done at Apache Point, or is that just one telescope in the system?
That's just the one telescope that's at Apache Point. There was some discussion at one point about packing up the whole operation and moving it off to the Southern Hemisphere, but I think they decided that that was going to be too expensive of a proposition.
Where is Apache Point? I've forgotten. I used to know.
Apache Point is in south central New Mexico, in among the peaks of the Sacramento Mountains. So it's about 9,000 feet or about 2,700 meters above sea level. And when you're standing up at the peak where the observatory is located, you look down into the Tularosa Basin to the west, and you can see the famous White Sands. So when people think of White Sands National Monument or the Missile Range, it's in the mountains that are above that valley that's situated in.
Cool. And 9,000 feet, great place. New Mexico, it's great skies.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Some of the darkest skies I've ever seen were during the time that I was working there.
So how does the Sloan Sky Survey compare to the recent news we just heard about the ESA's Gaia and the mapping of the Milky Way?
I would say that the Sloan Survey and Gaia, and then future efforts that are coming up, such as the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, are all highly complementary to each other. They're gathering immense volumes of data, so much so that we can't analyze that in real time anymore. And we're building up these archives that people are going to be mining probably for generations. Some of the newer projects are going to do because of the technology improvements is vastly larger in scale than we achieved with Sloan. But I think Sloan stands apart as one of the first very large scale sky surveys. And the number of papers and citations that have come out of it is just tremendous. And I think LSST is going to exceed that by a factor of 10 or 100.
See, LSST, isn't that the one that's going up in Chile?
Yeah, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what's the goal there? Is it to get the position, sky position, and the star type, amongst other things?
That's one of the goals. I would say that the bigger and more impactful thing that a project like LSST will do is that it moves the study of astronomy into what we call the time domain. So LSST is going to look at a big chunk of the sky. It'll take a few weeks to complete that. And then at the end of that process, it'll start it again. And then after a month, it'll do it again. And it will see this large volume. And over the length of time of the survey, not only can you stack all of those images together and see very, very faint things that we've never seen before, but then we'll be able to notice everything that changes, every variable star, every asteroid that wanders into the field of view. And that time domain astronomy is a really hot topic right now because there are a lot of phenomena in the universe that actually change on relatively short time scales, and we're still learning about that.
So we can sort of get a sense of the rotation of the galaxy and the proper motions of the stars and how they're moving around us over time, right?
We'll get that in combination with efforts like Gaia that are going to make the extremely high precision sort of spatial measurements of where objects are. But we'll also see things like gamma ray bursts and maybe more exotic phenomena that have to do with high energy sort of situations in the universe, like quasars and things like that. And most of the big sky surveys in the past, they always discovered something serendipitously that wasn't known before. And I imagine that LSST is going to take us places as far as new discoveries that right now we can't even fully appreciate.
Cool, cool. So you worked as an astronomer at Apache Point for a while, and then I think you went back to school at Texas Austin to get your PhD. Is that right?
It did. I left after 5 years at the observatory. The working at night for that many years eventually starts to wear on people. And I was one of those people who was less happy at the end of the experience. Not because the work wasn't engaging, but the hours weren't conducive to having something resembling a normal life, especially when you're living in the middle of nowhere. And so looking ahead towards the future, and given the realities, again, of that labor market in astronomy, it was pretty clear to me that the best thing to do moving forward would be to have that additional credential. And so I took the plunge at age 30 and went back to graduate school and got my PhD, and then basically immediately decided that the next phase of my life was going to be in something other than academia.
That happens to a lot of young people. It's a shock, I think, to a lot of young students who think maybe because of too much TV or movie watching that you can be, you know, 24 years old and be a PhD astronaut. And, you know, it takes a long time. You might graduate, you get your master's, you might serve in the military for a while, you might get a job. As you did, you might do some things and then go back to good school. And then there's the postdoc, which takes a few years. I talked to astronomer Kelly Holly Bachelman, and she said she was about 40 when she finished her postdoc. And then you get your first temporary faculty position, and you go, my goodness, where did my life go? I'm 40. So it happens.
It
does, decisions,
John,
must be made, especially if you have a family.
Decisions have to be made. Increasingly, people who go into this field should understand that maybe 10% of people who come through the pipeline of training are going to land in permanent positions in research. And the rest of us are going to have to figure out something else to do with our lives. But I will say, in defense of graduate training, that the PhD actually prepares you well to do a lot of different things. It gives you a lot of skills in your toolbox that can be called on to do creative problem solving in all manner of jobs. So looking back, even though the PhD training was intended to produce research astronomers, the program that I came from, of course, I feel like I walked away with a lot of skills that I could then take with me onto whatever I was going to do next.
We had this mantra at Lockheed Martin Astronautics: physicists make the best programmers, and they do.
That's right.
I wanted to ask you about your books. You've written a couple books on astronomy focused on the constellation. Tell me about those.
Yeah, so one of the other interests that I have besides science is history. It's good to be sort of well-rounded, I think. And merging together history and astronomy is something it's always been of interest, and I've read extensively. And I had a project in mind going back nearly 20 years when I ran across some references in what I was reading to constellations that used to appear on star maps in different periods in history. But around 1930, when the world's professional astronomers decided that they were going to settle on a list of constellations that everybody would agree were more or less official, some of these constellations were sort of tossed out. They were forgotten. And I was surprised to find that nobody had ever seemed to write in depth about that, because some of those figures have really interesting backstories. And so I just started keeping notes and eventually realized that there was maybe something of a book-length treatment here. And that turned out to be two books that are probably the most comprehensive thing that has been published on the subject to date.
So it's about time that we took a break in the second half of the show. I want to ask you about your work at the International Dark Sky Association and some other things. But first, we have to take a short break. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us. I'm chatting with Dr. John Barentine.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm back. I'm chatting with astronomer at the International Dark Sky Association, Dr. John Barentine. John, tell me how you got involved with the IDA, for starters, and then we'll chat about the goals and what it's trying to achieve.
I ended up at IDA, interestingly enough, because of Twitter, which is my preferred social medium, and I use it a lot for science communication. And around the time that I was finishing up my PhD, I did a very short stint as a postdoc, which was just to wrap up the remainder of the research that I'd done for my thesis. I turned out I was following on Twitter the person who would eventually become my boss at IDA, and the position was advertised for the program that I run now that is called International Dark Sky Places. And I, submitted an application and I got a quick call back to the effect of, can you come to Florida for a week? Long story short, by the time my visit there had ended, which had to do with some sea turtle work that the organization was doing at the time in the Florida Gulf Coast. And so my interview was basically tromping up and down beaches around sea turtle nests, trying to find all of the light that was shining on the beaches at night, because we know that light has a real strong impact on sea turtle populations. And at the end of the week, I had an offer. And for me, it was moving back to Tucson because I've now lived on and off here for about 25 years. And so for me, it was a good fit. It's an excellent program. And it was, in a way, nice to come home.
So the International Dark Sky Association is related to the classic question, which I will present to you in classic form. Why is it so important to walk outside on a clear night and see stars?
My inner astronomer answers that question, John, out of a belief that there is a lot that we can learn about the universe if we can see the night sky. It fires the imagination. It leads to questions about what those stars are, what the other things are in the universe. How did it all come to be? Part of that is scientific. Some of it leads to questions that may be, for some people, religious or spiritual. But we know that that night sky has also inspired humanity for many, many hundreds or thousands of human generations, who have created works of art and literature and music referring to it. But at the same time, we know so much more about this issue than we did 30 years ago when IDA was founded. And we know that the issue of natural darkness at night now touches on things as diverse as public safety and energy security to ecology, wildlife, and human health. So really, there's something in it for everybody, although it's true that for many of them, it starts with that experience of walking outside on a clear night under a genuinely dark night sky and just being blown away by what they see.
Here I am. I'm walking on a planet. I'm in orbit around the sun. This planet is a small, pale blue dot that I live on, and there's a universe out there that I'm interacting with, and that's important to think about those things, not only just for inspiration purposes to maybe become an astronomer, but to think about your place in the universe, as you said, and our position on the planet and the health of the planet. All those things come into play when we think about those things. Otherwise, all we see is just clouds, and we forget. Yeah.
And I think, John, that that's more important now than ever, at least in our recent history, because of what's happening in the world, generally speaking. But, the planet is also under threat for a variety of reasons that have to do with human activity. And I think the more people think about that planet and the context in which we live on it and how we live on it, it's important for the long-term survival of our species.
What are some of the things that the IDA does to try to promote this philosophy, projects, initiatives?
So I would say that right now, again, even after 30 years of our existence, we're still on the upward slope of the attention cycle to the issue of light pollution, so that it is still not thought of in the same sense in the mainstream sort of environmental movement, if you will, as air or water pollution, to use a couple of examples, because of course those are now regulated. The situation in many cases is improved because of those regulations. But light pollution is not like that. We're still in the phase where people are becoming aware of this issue. And I think what IDA does day in, day out that is most valuable to the solving this problem is raising public attention to it. And so people become more aware, in the thinking that eventually, if enough people become aware of it and agree that a problem exists, that they will begin to demand a solution. So one of the things we do is just simply, you know, try to get a lot of information out to the public. We do that through our website, our social media, or other communications. We run recognition programs like mine, International Dark Sky Places, where we try to recognize efforts where people are really trying to save these dark places in different parts of the world, but also where they're trying to roll back the problem somewhat in places like cities through effective public policy and education campaigns, et cetera. And then the sort of the third leg of that stool, if you will, is working with the lighting industry to try to promote better outdoor lighting, which was a philosophy going back to the founding of our organization, that we would have better results if we worked with the lighting industry to try to improve their product offerings rather than simply opposing everything that they did. And so I think we have been very successful in increasing the number of products that are on the lighting market, both here and elsewhere in the world, that it can be argued are much better for the night sky than what was typically available when we were founded in the late 1980s.
As I recall, one of the issues was high-pressure sodium lights versus low-pressure.
That was one of them. We were also, in the 80s, we still had a lot of legacy lighting that used mercury vapor as the lamp technology, is arguably much worse. So moving over to sodium was an improvement. Of course, now we're in the mode where we've moved into LED, and that has its own separate set of challenges that we're still trying to work out.
Yeah, I think one of the issues is the color temperature LEDs and the effect on people at night. And one of the other ones, I think, is that LEDs use less electricity, and so there's a temptation to overlight, maybe for security. I don't know.
Yes, and closely related to that, and something that we're just beginning to get information about, is apparently a rebound effect in the lighting world having to do with the cost savings from moving over to this energy efficient LED technology. And it's a principle from economics in the West that when something becomes less expensive to manufacture or a resource is easier to extract, we have a tendency to use more of it rather than less.
Yeah.
And so there's now some indication from satellite data that at least in Western countries that are fully industrialized, that the savings that are being achieved by moving to LED lighting are being plowed into distributing more lighting in the world. And so we have to worry that on the one hand, we want to promote energy savings because that's a laudable goal unto itself, but we're trying to convince people not to take those savings and use it to install more lights.
When your chapters work with cities, is there kind of a cold shoulder effect that lighting means security and that the astronomers are being kind of pushy here? Or do you find yourself working with cities who say, this is a good goal, let's try to work this out?
You know, John, we experience both of those situations. Oftentimes, the municipal governments themselves they're really amenable to the ideas and the recommendations that we have. But sometimes when they then go and try to enact them into law or to change city policies, that's when they begin to experience the pushback from the public, who are concerned that the goal is to just turn the lights out.
Yeah.
And that's an important point for me to make, that our goal as an organization has never been to solve the problem of light pollution by turning the world's lights out.
Smart lighting.
Yeah, it's not a realistic way of doing it. So exactly, we're trying to get people to think about how they use light under the presumption that if they think about it consciously, they'll decide that they need less of it to do the same thing. And so I'm something that I'll often tell people when I give public presentations and the like is that really what IDA's mission is slowly over time, we're trying to change the relationship that human beings have with all this outdoor light at night use.
Part of it is just fixtures, right? I mean, if you can direct the light downwards so that it's more efficient instead of upward and creating skylight, I mean, that's part of the problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you have a typical older style fixture, such as everybody knows the globe fixtures that have the kind of clear glass sphere around them as a cover. And if those radiate uniformly in all directions, that means that half of their light is directly emitted into the night sky. So if you put a proper shield on that, so now all the light were directed down, that means you would have double the amount of light that you did before on the ground. But if you had an adequate amount of light, you could reduce the lamp power by half and have precisely what you had before, except now you're not wasting anything.
Can homeowners get involved in this as well as cities, or is city the dominant problem so much that homeowners don't even have to sweat it? Because many of us have lamp posts and outdoor lighting at night. Is that something homeowners can even think about helping with?
Absolutely. I think it's like many acts in environmentalism, no act is too small. It's that notion of thinking globally while you're acting locally, so that every homeowner, business owner, et cetera, if they chose to do so, could start by just looking at the lighting on their property and seeing, you know, is this light necessary? Does it put the proper amount of light where I need it in order to, you know, make sure I don't trip over that step? Is it on during the right times of night? Does it make sense to have a light on all night if there's nobody around to use it? These are all things that apply just as equally to cities and determining how to light streets and parks and places like that, but they apply equally well to residential and business properties too.
Cool. Well, we're coming almost to the end of the podcast. We're not quite out of time yet. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the IDA that I have not covered?
No, all I would add is that we have a tremendous amount of factual and very timely information about the issue on our website, which is darksky.org. And I would encourage any of your listeners who have an interest in learning more about the subject to check that out and look for all the many practical solutions that we have on the website that can help them with their own individual lighting issues in their communities.
Do you accept monetary donations? Is it easy on the website to support you financially?
We do, and given that we are supported at about the 80% level by individual members, that is our lifeline.
Excellent. Okay, so we've told the listeners how they can get involved with darksky.org and how they can help financially, and now we have a pretty good understanding of what IDA is all about and what it tries to do. So thank you for sharing that with me. I think this is an important subject.
It's been a pleasure, John, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to your listeners about the subject.
Great. How can the listeners contact you personally if they want to learn more?
The best way is to look me up on Twitter. I am at John Barentine.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining me on the show. It's a pleasure to hear about your work and your career and what you're trying to do as a science communicator and involved with the IDA. So thanks again. It was a great show.
Thanks for the opportunity, John.
Folks, you've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week.